You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. A lot going on in the news. Bradley Manning was just sentenced to 35 years in prison. I'm going to riff on that in just a moment. Interesting story about Damon Holbrook. Damon Holbrook is a three-year-old, or was a three-year-old in northern Michigan. Family friend came to visit with a loaded gun, left it around. Damon picked it up, shot himself in the head. He's dead. Family friend was arrested and is being charged with homicide. Negligent homicide, specifically. Very interesting. Elizabeth Warren is speaking back to the Department of Justice saying, why, you know, you got this settlement with these banksters. Why is it, here's her phrase, timid enforcement strategy. Why? Rick Perry, meanwhile, is begging the White House for $100 million in Obamacare funding, but he's trying to do it in a way that nobody will find out about. So, of course, Center for American Progress put it up on the top of their blog. The Obamas have a new dog. Right. They had one of their kids, apparently, is allergic to pet dander, which is not uncommon. They would have a really tough time on our boat. Three cats. Well, anyhow. And Portuguese water dogs don't have fur. They have hair. And so people who have allergies to dogs, this is one of the very few dog breeds that you can get for somebody who's allergic. Portuguese water dogs are also black. They got a second one, although one has got some white on him. They got a second one. Here are a couple of hits on this. Number one, oh, my God, it's another black dog in the White House. Seriously. Yes. And number two, they named the dog Sunny. And so there's a couple of right-wing websites saying, no, it's actually Sunni, S-U-N-N-I, as in the Muslim, you know, Sunni versus Shia. So, yeah, a Muslim dog in the White House, a black Muslim dog in the White House. And finally, they did a survey in Louisiana. Remember where Hurricane Katrina hit when George Bush was president down in Louisiana, wiped out the coast, killed all kinds of people? You know, please help us. New Orleans is underwater. They surveyed Republicans last week. Who was responsible for the bad response to Hurricane Katrina back in 2005? 29% of Louisiana Republicans say President Obama was to blame. 28% say George W. Bush. Believe it or not. Well, this is the state that elected Bobby Jindal. Massive crisis going on in Japan. We're going to get to that. In fact, Kevin Camps from Beyond Nuclear is going to be here with us. Peter Farrar is going to be with us in our second hour, trying to tell us that you can get rich on welfare. This is going to be entertaining. But let's start with Bradley Manning. He's the soldier who was found guilty of leaking 750,000 pages of classified government documents to WikiLeaks. A little over 3 years ago, he was sentenced this morning to 35. Did I say 30 years earlier? It's 35 years in prison. He also got a dishonorable discharge, and he was stripped of his rank and his pay. In about 10 years, he will be eligible for parole, so it's not inconceivable he could be out in 10 years. We'll see. He's also getting credit for the 3.5 years that he spent in custody, which, you know, works into that 10 years. He's, as this young man prepares to spend the next, you know, arguably most significant chunk of his life, his 20s and 30s behind bars, maybe his 40s and 50s, we'll see. His being sent to prison raises what I think is a really important question. Bradley Manning was sentenced to 35 years in prison for leaking stories about other people's crimes. And many of those crimes are just as serious as leaking top secret information. Frankly, I think they're more serious. I think murdering people, killing hundreds of thousands of people is far more serious than leaking classified information. So, simple question. Where are the punishments for the people behind the crimes revealed by Manning? Where's the punishment for John Yoo, University of California, Berkeley professor of law, or Jay Bybee? George W. Bush put him on the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, lifetime federal judge. Where's the punishment for these two? These were the guys who wrote the infamous torture memos back in August 2002 and March of 2003, which authorized the Bush administration to use certain enhanced interrogation techniques. The rest of the world calls this stuff torture. But the Bush administration chose to use the phrase enhanced interrogation, a phrase that was developed by the Nazis. John Yoo wrote the March 2003 memo, which argued that federal laws on the use of torture, they don't apply to American interrogators overseas. Bybee was Yoo's boss. He authored the earlier 2002 memo in August. And these two memos set up Abu Ghraib, all the abuses, the renditions, the black holes. Detainees at Abu Ghraib were physically and sexually abused, raped, sodomized, waterboarded. And in many cases, killed. Yet despite these atrocities, John Yoo and Jay Bybee have yet to face any punishment for their crimes, or at the very least, deplorable actions. But it gets worse. The military commanders who ordered an attack on Baghdad on July 12, 2007, that killed scores of innocent civilians and two Reuters journalists. Now, you remember the video from the helicopter? Again, you see the dead body. You see people dying right in front of you. Whoever ordered that attack and whoever was flying that helicopter and pulled the trigger, we don't even know who they are. But they almost certainly have not been punished. If anything, they got promoted. Manning's leaks revealed that U.S. military officials deliberately withheld information about the killings. That's why he leaked it, because we were covering it up. And it was that video that ignited the firestorm over WikiLeaks and started our government's efforts to hunt down Bradley Manning. And finally, where the hell are the punishments for the Bush administration members who led us into one of the bloodiest wars in history under false pretenses and rigged intelligence? Why aren't the war criminals George W. Bush and Dick Cheney behind bars for killing hundreds of thousands of innocent civilians, authorizing the torture of prisoners of war, and taking the lives of thousands of American soldiers? I mean, very much like LBJ and Richard Nixon with regard to the Vietnam War, there is no doubt in my mind that if there is a hell, these guys are going to rot in it. But how about today? How are Condoleezza Rice and Donald Rumsfeld still walking around free after they lied to us and the world to get George Bush's war? And then there's Colin Powell. Usually he gets ignored, but Powell stood up in front of the United Nations on February 5th, 2003 and told lie after lie after lie to world leaders. And we now know that people on his staff, anyway, the information handed to him was fabricated and that he had been told that it was lies. And he got in front of the UN and he said, my colleagues, every statement I make today is backed up by sources, solid sources. These are not assertions. These are facts. Despite lying to the world, like the rest of the Bush administration, not only Powell has escaped, not only has he escaped any kind of punishment, he's got rich. He's a multimillionaire now. Bradley Manning said that he did what he did because he was disillusioned by U.S. foreign policy that was, in his words, hell-bent on killing and capturing people. He opened our eyes. But the people who actually were hell-bent on killing and capturing people, who actually committed these atrocities, they have yet to spend one day in prison, one day in a county jail, one day even getting a hard question from David friggin' Gregory, let alone 35 years. I mean, Dick Cheney is still treated like he's a human being. George Bush, let's honor him at the White House. Really? Where's the outrage for the crimes that Bradley Manning exposed?
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I mean, he stood up like a man and took his medicine, okay? He leaked this stuff, 35 years in jail. Why isn't Bush in the dock? Well, Bo Biden he's got something going on in his brain. Bo Biden's been a guest on this program a number of times. He's the AG of Delaware, as I recall, the Attorney General, and has been going after the banksters. He's of course, Vice President Biden's son, and a good guy. So if you're the prayer and kind, keep him in your prayers. I just find this astounding that more Republicans in Louisiana think that President Obama is responsible for the slow response to Hurricane Katrina in the middle of the Bush presidency than Republicans. I'm just boggled by that. So, anyhow, that said, it's Anything Goes Summer. Tony in Stafford, Virginia. Hey, Tony, what's up?
Yeah, I got a question about Detroit. Keep hearing about Detroit going bankrupt and all that. But in February, and as late as May that I've seen, the state of Michigan is saying that they're having a budget surplus of something like $400 million to almost $1 billion.
But they can't use that to bail out Detroit because Detroit is full of poor and black people, you know?
Yeah, but still Detroit has people working there. They're paying state taxes,
yep.
So why can't they get some of that money back?
Because Detroit is, the city of Detroit votes almost entirely Democratic, and the state House of Representatives, the state Senate, and the state governor's office in the state of Michigan are all occupied by Republicans. And when given an opportunity, Republicans will always do whatever they can to damage the lives of people who identify themselves as Democrats.
Yeah, but with the things that I'm noticing, too, about Detroit is all the fixes that they are proposing are short-term fixes.
Well, and not only that, they all bail out the banksters. And in Detroit, and this is the case in many places around the United States, the way the Social Security law was originally written, if you're working for a city, you and the city and the way you work out the contracts, and there's some, legal detail to it that I don't quite frankly understand, but nonetheless, they can say, okay, you can opt out of Social Security, so you don't have to pay Social Security out of your wages, so you actually get a little larger paycheck, but then they take money out for your pension, so when you retire, you don't have any Social Security. All you have is a pension. And so you've got, and that's the case with most of these folks in Detroit, you got 20,000 people who are living on an average of around $19,000 a year, a lot of them a lot less than that, some of them a little bit more than that, but an average of basically the poverty level for a family of four. And these are retirees, right? These are people over 65. They will not get Social Security when Rick Snyder takes their pensions away. They will get nothing.
Well, that's the way the federal government was before, when they had the old civil service retirement system.
Yeah.
They opted out of paying Social Security.
Yeah.
But when they switched to FERS, then they went under Social Security and all that. And from my understanding, if a company can prove that they have a viable retirement plan, they can opt out of Social Security.
Yeah, I don't think companies can. I think only cities can, but I could be wrong on that. But in any case, this is a great demonstration of why either A, we should go back to the pre-Reagan standards of it is impossible to strip Social Security out in a bankruptcy, whether it's a corporate bankruptcy or a municipal bankruptcy, because it used to be against the law to do. And we should either go back to that, or we should say if somebody loses their pension, at the very least they're going to get a roughly equivalent amount of money from Social Security or the FPIC, Federal Pension Insurance Corporation, I think it's called. Tony, thanks for the call. Excellent point. Ed, in Klamath Falls, Oregon, you wanted to talk about Bradley Manning.
Yeah, I remember watching Barack Obama declare that he was guilty on public on TV.
Yeah.
The man's the commander of the military. How do you possibly receive a fair trial under military justice when the commander of the military has decided the case before the case was heard?
Well, I suppose the good news is that Barack Obama was not the judge, but Bradley Manning never tried to pretend that he didn't release that information, to the best of my knowledge. I mean, it took them a while. It took them a couple of weeks to track him down. But once they did, I think he was fairly forthcoming about it. So arguably, President Obama was not speaking an untruth. And if you had a jury, I suppose you could bias it. Judges are not supposed to be biasable. But I don't disagree that that was an inappropriate thing for the president to say, given that there was going to be a criminal trial. And Ed, if I was sitting with President Obama right now, I would say, sir, so you got 35 years for the guy who revealed the crimes. What are you going to give the people who committed the crimes? When is that going to start? At what day? At what time? When is that going to start? Rick in Weston, West Virginia. Hey, Rick, what's up?
Hey there, Tom.
Hey.
Yeah, this whole Bradley Manning thing, you know, there's such thing as a military code of justice. You have a lot of soldiers with consciences. I figured that he knew what he was facing when he did it. He did a service to the American people. There's no doubt about that.
Well, not only that, the international rules of war explicitly, and there are rules for war, explicitly say, and in fact, the U.S. rules for war say, if your commanding officer or the people in your platoon or whatever are committing criminal acts, it is your obligation to disobey orders if you're asked to participate in those criminal acts and to expose those criminal acts.
Okay.
And just saying I was just following orders, that's the Nuremberg defense. It doesn't work. He did the right thing.
Well, see, that's another thing I couldn't understand. Now, after World War II, the Nuremberg trials, where all the war criminals were taken care of, that was conducted in a civilian, basically, well, military
right.
lawyers.
No, it was a civilian court in The Hague.
But it was a
multinational
civilian court.
Civilian court. Yeah.
And that's where we blew it in Abu Ghraib. And up until the last round of wars, waterboarding was against the American military code.
It still is.
Still is. That's right. We did the Japanese. We did the Koreans. We did the Vietnamese. But now it's all right.
Yeah.
So they twisted it all around. It's
very Oh, yeah. Cute. We actually, in the Spanish-American War, we actually executed Filipino officers for waterboarding American soldiers because it was considered torture. It was called Chinese water torture. Rick, thanks for the call. Excellent point.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
So, I mean, you know, the statute of limitations on murder is fairly long. Vince Bugliosi laid out a really great case for prosecuting George Bush. Do you think it's ever going to happen? And if so, how? 28 minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Howard in Fairview Heights, Illinois. Hey, Howard, what's on your mind today?
Hey, I just want to tell you that you're awesome to bring out the Bush Oil Company and Halliburton. Halliburton never, they never even bidded for any kind of bitch that they got.
Yeah, they got these no-bid contracts in Iraq. It was like, here, have some free money. Dick Cheney's vice president now.
You know, but Tom, I never thought anybody would have the guts to get on television and say what you said.
Well, hopefully I'll still be here tomorrow.
But I thank God that you're fearless. And because these people started a war, see, the Bush Oil Company and Halliburton, owned by Cheney, they started the war to make profit. They didn't care who died in that war.
Yeah. No, I absolutely agree with you. It's the reason why I think that George W. Bush and Dick Cheney are both sociopaths. I think they are that rare breed of human being who is incapable of empathizing with other people. Each one of them thinks that they're the only real human being in the entire world. So if people die, so what? No big deal. Because, I mean, you know, George Bush, we've got a clip of Cindy Sheehan, Howard. You will appreciate this. Cindy Sheehan was testifying before Congress under oath and in front of John Conyers' committee. And I spent about a half hour with John Conyers just a couple weeks ago and reminded him of this. We talked about it briefly. And when he was investigating how Bush got into the war in Iraq, and back in 1999, Bush ran in 2000. So the year before he ran, they, you know, whenever somebody's going to run for president, they release a book, right? Mitt Romney's book was called No Apologies, and they do a book tour and all this kind of stuff. And so Bush had to have a book come out. Well, Bush doesn't know how to write a book. So they hired this guy named Mickey Herskowitz, who is a family friend of the Bush family, good friend of Poppy Bush and Barbara, you know, the Bush, George W.'s parents. And Mickey's a Texas writer. He's written a lot of books. He's a famous ghostwriter. He writes for other people. And he wrote this book called A Charge to Keep for George W. Bush, or he actually wrote the first draft. They hired a second ghostwriter to finish it. And he had like 100 hours of tape-recorded conversations with George W. Bush. And on the record, Mickey Herskowitz shared a comment that George W. Bush made to him even before he announced he was going to run for president, about how if he became president, he was going to have a war in Iraq, even though they had nothing to do with anything. And keep in mind, this was 2 years before 9/11, that he was going to have a war in Iraq because it would help him win elections, win the 2004 election, and how his daddy blew it because he only had a 100-hour war in Iraq. He could have, if his dad had just let that war go on for another 6 months, he would have gotten reelected. And also that it would give him enough political capital to have a successful presidency. That was George W. Bush's phrase, which he defined as being able to privatize Social Security, which is the platform that he ran on when he unsuccessfully ran for the House of Representatives in 1978. Here's Cindy Sheehan testifying under oath before Congress, quoting Mickey Herskowitz. Just listen to this, Howard.
As a matter of fact, in interviews in 1999 with respected journalists and longtime Bush family friend Mickey Herskowitz, then Governor George Bush stated, "One of the keys to being seen as a great leader is to be seen as commander-in-chief. My father had all this political capital built up when he drove the Iraqis out of Kuwait, and he wasted it. If I have a chance to invade, if I had that much capital, I'm not going to waste it. I'm going to get everything passed that I want to get passed, and I'm going to have a successful presidency," end quote.
There you go. And then she goes on to say, it looks like my son, her son Casey, was doomed because that decision had been made before he even joined the military. So, Howard, it's... Go ahead.
But like Bush's brother was over the Port Authority's with the Twin Towers and told everybody to back off.
There's a therefore about that though, Howard. Bush's brother Marvin had been in charge of security for the Twin Towers, but it was a year and a half before 9/11. He was out of the picture by that time. Now there are some people who make something out of that, and they come up with all these theories about it. But I'm a little more sanguine about that. I'm a little less. I think just planning on having a war, which means killing people, planning on having a war just so that you can privatize Social Security and get yourself reelected. That, in my mind, is the mind of a criminal. Howard, I got to move along. We got a bunch of calls. People want to get in here. Thank you for the call, and thanks for your kind words. Ken, in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, you want to talk about Dick Cheney?
I reiterate my question. I think the public would like to know how much the Cheney Corp people are still making off Obama every month or so. And
Halliburton's doing real well. They're doing real well. They were on the verge of bankruptcy when Cheney became vice president. And, you know, in February and in March, he was put on the Energy Task Force and the Counterterrorism Task Force. Those are the two jobs George Bush gave him. Counterterrorism Task Force never met until September of 2001. This was the one that was supposed to stop bin Laden. So, of course, 9/11 happened. The Energy Task Force, however, was meeting in February and March, and Larry Klayman, who runs this right-wing group down in Florida called Judicial Watch, he sued the Bush administration and actually got the documents from that meeting. You can find them online, where Dick Cheney and a bunch of guys from the oil industry executives from all over the world, no environmentalists allowed, were meeting in the White House, carving up the oil fields of Iraq. And this was before 9/11 and before the declaration of war in Iraq. These guys were ready to go.
So I've heard. Well, my point, I guess, today is, our Constitution is not for the good times. It's for us to hold tight to during the bad times.
Well said.
To show what kind of people that we are.
Well said.
And these criminals, these traitors and murderers and criminals have gotten away with it, and our current president turned his back on that criminality. A constitutional scholar who should have known better.
Yeah.
And at this point, the only problem that Cheney might have is if a survivor of the millions that he has killed comes over and does to him what he did.
Well, no, listen, I'm not going to go there. I'm sorry. It's Ken. I'm not going to wish harm to any of these people. I am wishing a judicial process to them. You don't, you know, an eye for an eye just leaves everybody blind. It's real simple. And yes, these guys are war criminals. Yes, they should be in the dock. Yeah, but I don't even want the death penalty for them. I'm opposed to the death penalty. I think that whereas in Nuremberg, you know, those folks were hung, I think that these people should be spending the rest of their lives in prison for the millions. I mean, 5 million refugees in Iraq, 2 million of them outside the country, 3 million inside the country, several hundred thousand people killed, 4,000, 5,000, 6,000 U.S. soldiers in aggregate in both the wars dead, 30,000, 40,000 Americans wounded, missing legs, arms, eyes, brain damaged, post-traumatic stress disorder. A country in Iraq where they've got the highest birth defect rate in the world right now, because we covered that world with depleted uranium, and people are giving birth to children with one eye and no jaws and one arm. And I mean, you know, literally the worst, most horrible disfigured birth defects you could ever imagine. And a not insignificant problem with birth defects with U.S. soldiers coming home because they were exposed to that depleted uranium. And if they're women, their eggs were damaged. And if they're men, as long as that uranium's in their body, their sperm is damaged and they are producing. George Bush opened the gates of hell to several million people. And he is not being held accountable. John in Rutland, Vermont. Hey, John, what's up?
Hello?
Yeah, you're on the air, John.
Yes. First of all, thank you for being Tom Hartman.
You're welcome. I don't have much choice.
If you were here, the pull, I could give you a big hug.
Okay. Well,
I have something I need to pick your brain on. Number one, I have heard this on three different occasions in the past 10 years, and I never was exuberant enough to go find a book or read it or check on it. Mm-hmm. But I have heard that there was a book written, and it was called The Unholy Trinity. And I was told that in this book, back in the Second World War, when Hitler was exterminating the Jews, that they would go through these ovens and they would strip them of all of their possessions and clothing. And all of the gold and jewels and all of the precious things that they had was sent to a bank. And this bank was in New York, and it was put together quickly by Bush's grandfather or great-grandfather. And
Prescott Bush was his name, and it. I don't know the story that you're telling, but I can tell you, Prescott Bush was a partner in Brown Brothers Harriman, which was actually almost prosecuted. They were indicted during the Roosevelt administration by Franklin Roosevelt for doing business with the enemy, because after we had entered World War II, years after Hitler had started killing Jews, these guys were still doing business with Hitler. And it took the intervention of the president to stop it. And because Prescott Bush at the time, in addition to being a partner in Brown Brothers Harriman, I believe he was a senator at that time, at least he was a former senator, they ultimately chose not to prosecute him and his partners. They just forced him to stop doing business with the Nazis. Whether there had anything to do with, you know, gold from the teeth of Jews or anything like that, I don't know, and I frankly doubt it. But just doing business with the Nazis is enough. It's just enough. And that's kind of... You know, that's the Bush family. It's like George W. Bush took money from Salman bin Laden, Osama bin Laden's half-brother, for his oil company.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Back in the 80s, Salman bin Laden gave George W. Bush the money to start an oil company, Armbusto Oil Company. That oil company went bust, and then, you know, shortly later, bin Laden's brother dies in a plane crash in Texas. 10 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you, and Kevin Camps, the radioactive waste watchdog at beyondnuclear.org, is on the line with us. Kevin, welcome back to the program.
Thanks so much, Tom.
The Japan, the Nuclear Regulatory Agency of the country of Japan today, I believe, or maybe it was yesterday, raised the nuclear alert. You can tell us all what the language is, but they kicked this thing up from a 1 to a 3. What's at Fukushima? What's the significance of this? What's going on?
Yeah, the International Atomic Energy Agency, which is an agency of the United Nations.
Ah.
Supposed nuclear safety regulator, but it's a nuclear power promoter by mandate, has this International Nuclear Event Scale, INES. It's got 7 stages on it. And this leak that just happened from these storage tanks at Fukushima Daiichi originally the Japan Nuclear Regulation Authority was going to make it a one, which officially is a, technically called an anomaly. Well, just in the last 24 hours, as you said, they're now talking a three, which is a serious incident, and that's a hundredfold increase in severity,
right.
And that is regarded as serious. And seven is the highest rung on this ladder, which is a global catastrophe, in my words, and only Chernobyl and Fukushima Daiichi have reached the seventh rung on this scale. But as a colleague, John LaForge with NukeWatch in Wisconsin put it, back at the time, 2.5 years ago, well, there were three meltdowns and four explosions at Fukushima Daiichi. So isn't that at least a 3 times 7 or a 21 on this scale? So this latest leak of 300 tons of highly radioactive water into the soil, flowing now with the groundwater towards the ocean, you know, they call it a 3, but, you know, the ocean is just getting hammered at Fukushima
Daiichi. Is this a logarithmic scale, the way the Richter scale is?
Yes, it is. Each rung on the ladder is 10 times more serious.
So going from 1 to 2 isn't doubling it, it's increasing it tenfold, and going from 2 to 3 is increasing it 100-fold from the 1 or tenfold from 2.
And the Nuclear Regulation Authority has admitted, you know, a 100-fold increase in the seriousness.
Why has this not been called a 7?
Well, you know, the 7 might be if another earthquake hits the site, and they have something like 262 of these giant tanks, the same design, the same size as the one that just leaked.
So let's just recap this. Out of these 262 tanks, one of them just leaked. Just leaked, what, yesterday, last week? How big is the tank? Where's the tank?
In the last day or two, they've admitted to this latest leak, and it's 300 tons of highly radioactive water. It's giving off a dose rate of 10 rem per hour, and the way they discovered the leak were puddles on the ground giving off 10 rem per hour. You could get a worker dose, which is a high thing, within 5 hours, and you could get a fatal dose just standing next to a 5 rem puddle, you know, after a certain amount of time.
Wow. And a rem, of course, is 1,000. I mean, there's 1,000. Is it 1,000 millirems or a million
yes.
millirems in a rem? 1,000.
1,000 millirem make 1 rem, and workers
and
internationally are limited to 2 rem per year.
Wow.
Members of the public to a mere 100 millirem per year under normal circumstances. So this thing is given off 5 rem per hour, I think, is the figure.
So that's pretty much the level of radioactivity that the core material itself would have, isn't it?
Sorry, I misspoke, 10 rem per hour from this puddle of water on the ground. No, if you get into the core material, I mean, you're talking just unimaginable dose rates. You're talking, I don't even know if it's millions of rems per hour.
Wow.
But that's an instant. If you were to get close to the cores without radiation shielding, you would be dead within a second.
Wow. Wow.
From gamma radiation.
What is the... So far, I mean, we've had a lot of workers, or Japan has had a lot of workers exposed to this. Has anybody disclosed the consequences of this? Do we know how many people have been directly affected by the Fukushima meltdown?
Well, even the Japanese government now admits that 10,000 Fukushima Daiichi workers will qualify, really, for lifetime coverage, at least health checkups and perhaps even compensation, because they've exposed themselves, they've been exposed to enough radiation dose to be at risk of leukemia. And there's other categories, probably thousands of Fukushima Daiichi workers are going to qualify for it, but there have been probably 100,000 workers on that site, all exposed to varying levels of radioactivity. So again, they're going to make it difficult for workers to qualify for those benefits, unfortunately.
What about the families who lived in this neighborhood when the plant went down and there was all that initial radiation that the government was pretending wasn't there?
Well, there's still 150,000 or more nuclear refugees scattered all over Japan, and they've left for other countries as well. And some of the startling, alarming news that's just coming out yet again is childhood thyroid cancer, which is a very rare disease. In fact, most years there are zero cases in 100,000 in Japan, and it looks like those numbers, at least in Fukushima Prefecture, are increasing among, you know, children and adolescents that were exposed to the radioactive iodine-131, which is a vicious poison that attacks the human thyroid gland.
Right, right. And this is terrible. So, Kevin, what can they do? They've got these buildings that are tottering. They're on an earthquake fault zone. At the top of these, you know, 5-10-story buildings, they've got these giant pools filled with radioactive material. Rather than at ground level, And what's next?
Well, Tokyo Electric is admitting it's beyond their coping ability. They're asking for international assistance at long last. The Japanese government just in the last couple of weeks has said we're going to step in. This is under, you know, a pro-nuclear Prime Minister, Abe.
Yeah.
So finally, there's some recognition that this is just out of control. And you mentioned, why not a level 7? Well, if a big earthquake hits that site and hundreds of these containers were to let loose the hundreds of thousands of tons of highly radioactive water they contain, I think that might certainly qualify as a level 7.
How are they getting all these containers there? They're just all over Japan. They're building, you know, 100-ton water containers and shipping them to Fukushima to fill with water. Is that the deal?
Yeah, those 262 giant tanks are actually, I think the figure is 1,000-ton water tanks, and the one that leaked 300 tons of its 1,000-ton capacity. But there's even smaller sized, and you're talking now not 262, but many hundreds of these tanks spreading onto the hillsides. They're building them and trying to keep up with this flood.
Amazing. Amazing. This is a disaster of unimaginable proportions, and it's a disaster that could happen at any one of over 100 nuclear power plants in the United States. And we have over 30 or over 50 nuke plants built in the same model as the Japanese. Which is it, Kevin? We've lost.
We have 23 identical designs and another 8 that are very similar.
Okay. Thank you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. 6 minutes past the hour. Anything goes summer. We'll be picking up your calls in just a moment. But first, on the line with us, our old friend Peter Ferrara, who is currently an attorney and fellow at the Carlson Center for Public Policy. TheCCPP.org is the website. Hey, Peter, welcome back.
Glad to be here.
Thank you. You and I are both, I'm assuming you're looking at it or you've read it, this new Cato Institute study by Michael Tanner and Charles Hughes called The Work versus Welfare Trade-Off 2013, an analysis of the total level of welfare benefits by state. Are we on the same page here?
Well, I haven't read that. No, nobody told me about that, but I can comment on the ideas. I'm certainly familiar.
Well,
with
in that case, then we can just discuss the situation in the abstract, if you'd prefer.
All right.
In this report, in any case, they talk about how much money people get when they're living on welfare, you know, and they make so much money that why bother going to work? But what I don't understand is why anybody in the United States would argue that food, which is, you know, something if we don't have, we die, that food isn't a basic human right. That people who are hungry, whether it's because they are disabled and they can't work, whether it's because they were born in grinding poverty, whether it's because they're born in part of the country where there's no jobs, or even if it's because they're lazy, why people who are hungry should not be fed.
Well, I'm in favor of a safety net to make sure that there's no human suffering for any American.
So you are in favor of food stamps.
But I'm not in favor of any taxpayer assistance for people who don't want to do anything more than sleep till noon and watch TV all afternoon. So that's my position.
So how do you know?
Well, and for example, you can have a work requirement, which says if you're able-bodied.
Right, we've got that. Bill Clinton put that into place.
Well, that was for one program. That was the old AFDC program, which is now the TANF program, Temporary Assistance to Needy Families.
Right.
That's one program out of 200 federal means-tested welfare programs. So I would extend the work requirement to all of the remaining federal means-tested welfare programs. And that one program, the work requirement, was an enormous success. Two-thirds of the people on the program went out to work, and their incomes were documented in studies to increase.
Well, that's because that was in the middle of the Clinton administration when we had this incredible dot-com bubble, plus Bill Clinton had raised taxes on rich people, which, as we all know, stimulates the economy. So the economy was growing quite rapidly during that time. More jobs were available, and I think pretty much everybody would rather have a job than be on welfare. Right now, though, you've got more people on welfare than ever before, and it's not because they want to sit around and, you know, eat Doritos and watch TV. It's because there's no work out there. You know that.
What I know is I lived with people last year and observed them sleeping till noon and watching television all afternoon with their kids who were receiving food stamps.
Yeah.
And so I don't favor
Well, that's a shame, but isn't there – I mean, here's the conservative argument for this, Peter. And I'd love to get your take on it. This is the very just looking at the money part of it. On the assumption that we both share that there should be a social safety net through which people don't fall. There is always going to be, there always have been. I mean, Ben Franklin wrote about this in his autobiography. You're probably familiar with that, where he went over to England and he was horrified by people on the dole. And he talked about people need an incentive to work. There have always been, there will always be, to paraphrase Jesus, the poor among us. And of them, there will always be this small percentage. And it's there's been a number of attempts to quantify it. And it seems like the broad consensus is around 3%. The what they call the hardcore unemployed, the permanently unemployed, the people who simply don't want to work. So there's always going to be that 1-3% of Americans and or of any citizens of any kind of nation who are going to abuse the system. The cost of putting the other 97% of people who are legitimately hungry, legitimately needy, legitimately in need of assistance, having them show up 2-3 times a month at the office, having them document all their attempts to get work, having them be inspected, have all these bureaucrats who are following them around and making sure that nobody's gaming the system, the cost of maintaining that work requirement is greater than the amount of fraud, if you want to call that fraud, that it prevents. It seems to me like we should just say, you know, there's always going to be 1-3% of Americans who are just going to be, you know, bums. They're not going to want to work. And you can call it a mental illness or you can call it whatever you want. But, you know, most people would rather work than not. And we're just going to take that into account, figure that's a cost of doing business for us as a nation with, you know, with some kind of decent sense of humanity. And do like the you know European countries with more generous social programs do, say, yeah, there's going to be some people who are gaming the system, but the cost of trying to stop them is greater than the cost of letting them game the system. So what the heck?
No, I don't agree that the cost of the work requirement is more. In fact, when they adopted the work requirement for the old AFDC program, the cost of the program declined by 50% from where they would have been otherwise. Under prior trends. That was after 10 years.
That was because the number of people on the program went down.
Yes, because with the work requirement, you eliminated the incentive not to work, and so people went to work.
Well, it did it over a period of, what was it, 4 years, the Clinton thing? 4 or 5 years, wasn't it? You could only be on?
Well, this was you know, there was a retrospective done after 10 years, and these were the results. I mean, two-thirds of the people had gone to work.
Right.
Because
we were living in good times.
Two-thirds.
We were living in good times. But what do you get?
That's not difficult to do, actually. You can adopt, actually, pro-growth economic policies. But
I agree. Let's roll back the Reagan tax cuts and let's do away with globalism and bring back our jobs. You know, I really think that if you look at the times when America's labor market was tight, you know, in the 50s, 60s, 70s, early 80s, during the Clinton years when the labor market was tight, unemployment dropped. I mean, we've had unemployment in the United States as low as 3-4%. That's where you're hitting that. Those are the folks who actually don't want to work. And I'm willing to have 3 cents out of every dollar I send go off, you know, that ends up supporting people who are hungry. I'm willing to spend that 3 cents to care for people who really don't want to work as long as I know with great certainty that the rest of the people are getting what they want. And you say it's less expensive, but you're not factoring in the human cost. I remember the first time I ever went on, actually the only time I ever went on unemployment. I was 18, 19 years old, 20 years old, something like that, and I had lost my job. And I signed up for unemployment, and it was a brutalizing experience standing in line. It was a humiliating experience. And putting people through that, that doesn't lift them up. It doesn't encourage them to get out and do more. It just beats them down.
Well, there's no human cost to going to work. And the official U.S. government data shows there is very little work among the bottom 20% of the income earners. And that has occurred after the adoption of the war on poverty. So that work has collapsed because taxpayers are paying $1 trillion a year. That's another official government figure, are paying $1 trillion a year to them not to work.
Well, no, we're paying $1 trillion a year to people who are the victims of Reaganomics, Peter.
That's why the bottom 20% of income earners do not work, because taxpayers are paying them $1 trillion not to work.
Wait a minute. How can they be income earners if they're not working?
Well, that's income earners used loosely, because we're referring to income being earned when, in fact, it's given away to them at taxpayer expense. But
so they're not income earners.
No, the bottom 20% of the income distribution, which you correctly say should not be considered income earners, engage.
Well, no, I think they are income earners. If they got a job and they're making an income.
I don't know. When I say income earners, you dispute it. Then when I
okay, well, here's another part of the problem, and that is that we're subsidizing Walmart.
Income earners or not.
Okay.
And don't correct me one way and then correct me the opposite way in the next sentence.
Well, that's my prerogative. I get to be fickle.
Yeah, well, I know. You do that a lot on your show.
Okay. Peter Ferrara, theCCPP.org is his website. Attorney and fellow at the Carlson Center for Public Policy. Always a pleasure talking with you, Peter. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Thank you. Bye now. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And Peter wasn't familiar with it, so I didn't want to get through it. But I'll share with you this Cato Institute study and how it proves that figures don't lie, but liars can figure. Welcome back, Tom Hartman, here with you. Okay, the way that they... I just find this incredible. This, according to the Cato Institute, the former Charles Koch Foundation, you know, now called the Cato Institute, if you live in the District of Columbia and you don't want to work, you can make $43,099 a year just sponging off the government. Now, I know a lot of people in this city who make less than $40,000 a year. I know people in this city who make less than $20,000 a year. And why is it that you can make $43,000 a year doing absolutely nothing? Well, it turns out, according to the Cato Institute, you can get emergency housing assistance, TANF, worth $5,100 a year. And you can get housing assistance at $21,775 a year. Together, that's $27,000, they say. The problem, of course, is that you have to pick one or the other. You can't get both. And only a small number of people qualify for each one. And then they say, snap, a food stamps, you get $6,000 a year. And that, of course, is going to vary from person and family and whatnot. And then they say, Medicaid, you get $8,000 a year. You don't get a penny from Medicaid. You may have access to services. So they're saying you're going to get $8,000 worth of health insurance from Medicaid. In what universe? They're saying that's equivalent to an $8,000 commercial policy. Really? That's like, what is that, $700, $800 a month for health insurance? And then they're saying you get $1,000 under WIC, $600 under LIHEAP, LIHEAP's low-income heating program. Now, how do you get that $600 if you don't own your own house because you're renting on TAN for housing? It's not possible. And then this TFAP program, you get $300. That's emergency food. That's for people who are just plain old flat-out desperate. In other words, they're making up numbers. And they come right out and say, we're making up numbers. These Medicaid numbers, for example, just wild-ass guesses. My phrase, not theirs. It is incredible. I mean, but you're going to hear this. You're going to hear this. I guarantee you, this thing's going to be on Fox News. It's going to be on all the right-wing talk shows. It was on CBS already, Shano? Columbia Broadcasting Systems? They let somebody from the Cato Institute on? Amazing. Amazing. I hear these guys, Cato Institute, Heritage Foundation, Competitive Enterprise Institute. I hear them all the time on NPR, but that's, you know, I mean, NPR is taking right-wing money like there's no tomorrow. But the real networks, really? Wow. That's incredible. Anyhow, I just wanted to share that with you and let you know about it. Anything goes summer here. John in Coal City, Illinois. John, you are wondering why I'm picking on George Bush? Really?
Yes, I am. Not picking on him, but your judgment for him is a little bit different. Now, true, you identify him and Cheney as sociopaths and
war criminals.
Yes, don't forget that either.
Right.
And you could add Donald Rumsfeld and
I do. Paul Wolfowitz, Jeb Bush, the whole bunch of them. Yeah.
But see, what you're not saying is like this guy that called earlier and was talking about that Peter guy, talking about these bottom guys ripping off the government.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's like straining at a gnat and swallowing a camel.
I
don't say nothing about Mitt Romney paying less than 14%.
Right, but he's all upset about somebody getting food stamps. I got it. Yeah, you're absolutely right.
Now, see, this country is a terrified. I mean, fear is a major moving thing.
No, it's a major industry.
Fear. And, see, George Bush was great on the fear factor.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he wanted to go into that war, and he was commander-in-chief. And he's a real war criminal. Now, we got these people over there hating us more than anything alive. And to cut down on our fear of the terrorists, turn over to war criminals and let them justify the war criminals. We don't even have to waste our time with you.
Yeah, yeah. Amazing. Okay, John, I think that in particular your point about people who are freaked out about welfare and aren't and don't care about the fact that Halliburton made, where did I write that down, $28 billion last year, and this is a company that would have been bankrupt had Dick Cheney not become vice president and given them billions of dollars in no-bid contracts. $28 billion to Halliburton, no problem. What? There's somebody on food stamps who could work? We can't have that. Excellent point, John. Thank you for it. Marty in Evergreen Park, Illinois. Hey, you wanted to talk about radioactive groundwater? Marty? Okay, let's go to Jim in Norwood, New Jersey. You understand Bob in Tahlequah, Oklahoma, who called me up and said that, you know, why even bother, basically?
No. I don't agree with why no more. Why, don't bother.
Right.
No, what I was kind of, the point that I was agreeing with him is that, you know, realistically, there's a lot of people that are marginalized by fear of attention, guys that have been, take cash for jobs or contractors that might build a, there's so many different people that are doing work for, under the table.
Sure. Well, this is what the Reaganomics guys wanted, is they wanted a fearful underclass rather than a fearless middle class, and that's what they've got. But what Bob was saying was that me and all these politicians, Bernie Sanders and Sherrod Brown, that we were all cowards because we weren't calling out the right-wingers on what they were really up to and weren't promoting a progressive agenda. And I just said, that's cynicism. That, that doesn't work for me.
I think that's cynicism also, Tom, but to be realistic, the fear exists. We live in a country that's way more fearful.
Yeah, no, you're right, Jim. We have been a minute. Hang on.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
We have been manipulated by that fear, and you're right. George W. Bush was the master of it. And it's time for us to wake up and start being the land of the brave and the home of the free instead of the land of the fearful. Well, it looks like the IPCC has it doesn't look like. They've got a new report that's coming out at the beginning of next year, but the draft has been leaked, and they're saying, all these guys who are saying that there's no such thing as man-made climate change, well, they're full of it. What they're full of course, is money from Coke Oil Industries and ExxonMobil and BP and all the other companies that are funding right-wing politicians and scientists for sale and all that sort of thing, but the world is getting warmer, and it's not a good thing. That's the bottom line. Dean in Fernandina Beach, Florida. Am I saying that right, Dean?
You got it. I'm the Mad Hatter guy that called you a couple weeks ago.
Oh, we talked about Mercury.
Yes.
Yeah. So what's up?
I got kind of a question and a comment.
Mm-hmm.
What I'm calling on is that commercial, the Ted Cruz thing about defunding Obamacare, with that foolish lady who's on there saying that she's worried about losing her doctor, but if they don't fund Obamacare, the poor lady's, that kid's going to have a pre-existing condition, and she is going to lose her insurance. But anyway, what I'm...
Well, let me, Dean, if I may, if it's all right with you, unless it wouldn't work with what you intend to say, shall I play that ad for our listeners so they know what you and I are talking about?
Yeah.
Okay. Let me just play it. It's only a minute. We'll play the ad, then you and I will talk about it, okay? I'll leave you on the air during the ad. This is an ad that is being run by Americans for Prosperity, multimillionaire Dick Armey's right-wing group that's partly funded by the Koch brothers, to try to convince young people not to sign up for Obamacare. Now, Obamacare, of course, makes it illegal for the health insurance companies to kick people off their policies because their kid has a seizure, but obviously this lady doesn't know that. Obamacare has substantial subsidies, so your health insurance costs are going to go down, your paychecks are going to go up if your health care is taken out of your paycheck. She obviously doesn't know that, but anyhow, here's the ad right here.
In a few short months, Obamacare is set to take effect. Families and small businesses across the country are wondering, what will it mean for them? ABC News says confusion and doubt are prognosis for Obamacare.
This is a radio.
And NBC News said even doctors are skeptical and confused about Obamacare. People like Julie, a mother of three, have questions.
2 years ago, my son Caleb began having seizures. The medical care he received meant the world to me. Now, I'm paying more attention, and I have some questions about Obamacare. If we can't pick our own doctor, how do I know my family is going to get the care they need? And what am I getting in exchange for higher premiums and a smaller paycheck? Can I really trust the folks in Washington with my family's health care? I think we all deserve some answers.
To get answers about what Obamacare means for your family, please go to ObamacareRiskFactors.com. That's ObamacareRiskFactors.com. Paid for by Americans for Prosperity.
There you go. And I mean, it's just... It's like one lie after another. It's just astounding.
Yeah, I'm wondering who that lady is, and if she really doesn't know that, who her health care coverage is, you know, who's her health care provider, and, you know, whether or not she's just a shill who was hired to say that, and not, you know, like the union guy who turned out to be a rich white guy or whatever.
Yeah.
Remember?
Well, on TV, typically when they show somebody, you know, somebody gets in a doctor's outfit and says, you know, take Aquatala or whatever, and it'll make you feel wonderful. They have to say in small type down at the bottom, you know, a simulated doctor or an actor pretending to be a doctor or something like that. But on radio, I don't believe there's any such requirement. So she actually may be just a really badly misinformed young woman who Dick Armey and Americans for Prosperity was able to bamboozle into making an ad, which, if that's the case, probably by now she's had 1,000 relatives recognize her voice, call her up and set her straight. Or she might be a voice actress, you know, a radio talent person, who probably did the ad for a couple $100, and that was that.
Okay.
So that was your question?
Tom, but what I was calling about, let's say they are successful and the government shuts down.
Mm-hmm.
I've gotten varying opinions on whether or not the Social Security checks go out.
Right.
If they don't go out, I'm going to be late on all my credit card payments.
Yep.
I called all my creditors this morning, all of them, my electric company, my rental, and I got varying answers. One of your favorites, Wells Fargo, told me, well, that's your problem. You're going to have to get it, make the payment from another source
of income. Of course they
would say that. But I don't have another source of income. I'm living on Social Security.
Right.
And I was thinking, what about if thousands and thousands of people did what I did today? Everybody start calling up their creditors. And yeah, after so many calls, I would, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I don't know if I'm doing this for nothing. I've gotten varying answers about
right.
whether or not the Social Security will go out and won't go out. If I remember in 94, I think they did go out about
yes.
a week late.
Yeah, but the checks went out. First of all, the Republican establishment, the they call them the adults in the room. I'm not sure you can even call anybody who calls themselves a Republican an adult in the room. But nonetheless, the Republican establishment does not want to shut down the government. And as a way of forcing a defunding of Obamacare or just, you know, to throw a tantrum. They don't want that to happen. And the people, the big funders, the big corporate funders of the Republican Party, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce in particular, they opposed the last government shutdown and the attempt at it. They have consistently opposed the idea, and they're strongly opposing the idea right now. And the people that they fund, the kind of mainstream Republicans, the corporate Republicans, the John McCains of the world, they don't want the government to shut down. The problem is that you've got this political phenomena that was funded by the Koch brothers. And keep in mind, one of the two Koch brothers actually ran for president as a libertarian and then created the Cato Institute, created the Charles Koch Foundation, which became the Cato Institute. And they've got this whole infrastructure to fund this libertarian, idealistic, wouldn't the world be wonderful, wouldn't America be wonderful if we didn't have a government, if the government was relatively small and meaningless, which, of course, has never been tried anywhere in the world with any success. But they have enough people bamboozled by this. They've been able to put enough money, enough hundreds of millions of dollars into building this what started out as a phony grassroots movement, that they now have actual grassroots people who are absolutely convinced that everything the government does is bad and that, therefore, if you shut down the government, that would be a wonderful thing for America. And you've got elected officials who have to respond to that, because if they don't, they're going to get primaried. And then you've got the demagogues like Ted Cruz, who just, you know, sees this as a great opportunity to up his political capital. So I think that there's probably about a 10% chance that they will do it, that they will cause our government to default.
If they do it, will the Social Security checks go out?
Almost certainly.
Various answers.
Yes, almost certainly they will. That will be a decision that is made not by Congress, but by the White House, because Congress appropriates the money, but Congress does not have the authority to write a check. The executive branch of government administers the programs that the legislative branch of government authorizes and funds. And so what the executive branch of government, what I believe they did back in 94, although I'd have to go back and look, but what I certainly know they have the authority to do now, and they did do when they have done in the past when there have been interruptions or hiccups, shall we say, is they say, okay, we're going to take the money out of this program and put it into that program. And there are ways that they can shift money around and do that. So I would be astounded if the Obama administration stopped Social Security payments and SSDI payments, because they know that literally that's life and death for a lot of people.
But we said that about the sequester, and they went ahead and did that.
Yeah, and Obama, I mean, you recall during the presidential campaign, you know, Romney brought up the sequester, and Obama said, that's not going to happen. And I think he was dead serious. He never believed that the Republicans would be insane enough to do the sequester. And they've gone ahead and done it. And that's why I say I think there's a 10% chance they'll shut down the government. But I do think, Dean, that the president will prevent that from, you know, really whacking people hard. And, in fact, if he's got any smarts, he'll organize it in such a way that it whacks corporate America, particularly the billionaires, the hardest. And maybe that'll shake some sense into the Tea Party's, you know, into their folks. So anyhow, I that's the best I can do, Dean. I wish you the best. But I think, actually, back to your original point, if a lot of people were to call the people to whom they are creditors, or debtors, rather, if they were to call their creditors and say, you know, I rely on government income, and if the Republicans succeed in shutting down the government, I may not be able to pay you. I would be a little wary of that, because they might end up putting you know, dropping your credit rating or putting you on a watch list. I'd be very wary about that. But if you do it in a way where you're not actually identifying yourself, and in this day of caller ID, I realize that can be fairly hard to do, but just asking the question, if enough companies get asked that question, they might start getting nervous. We'll see. So
that's what I was thinking.
Yeah. Yeah. So what you're doing is strategic. You're doing political jujitsu here. And it seems like an interesting strategy. Dean, thanks for the call. I would try. You know, if I was living on government income, I was going to say, even if I wasn't, but, you know, I'm not a fan of dishonest politics. But I think that in addition to calling your creditors, I would hope, and I, you're off the board now, so I don't remember what city you were calling from, but if you have Republican legislators, I would hope you would call them.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Because they need to know that their constituents don't want to see the government shut down and that there will be a political price to pay. We'll be right back. It's the place where despair is not an option and neither is cynicism, frankly. The Tom Hartman Program. Bob Ney with the Talk Radio News Service brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com. On the line with us. Hey, Congressman, how are you?
Hello, Tom. How are you?
I am well, thank you. What's going on in the world?
Well, we have a report in. Luke Vargas has sent us a note. He's from Talk Radio News Service, covers the UN for us, and he said that our reporter, Zach Badawar, who's on the ground in Turkey, has said that there are more than they fear 1,600 people that have died in a chemical weapons attack in Damascus itself. And if this is true, then it's just going to be, you know, comparable to the Bosnian genocide.
Right. And now, my understanding about that, Bob, and correct me if I'm wrong, because the news reports seem to be all over the place, but apparently some observers went to this region to investigate evidence of a previous gas attack, and while they were there, this new gas attack happened, and which is causing some folks to say this wasn't the government doing it. This was the, quote, rebels or the al-Qaeda faction of the rebels because they knew that there would be observers there and they wanted there to be some good television footage, and there is. And, you know, so you hear, you know, all of these different conspiracy theories and stories. Is there any solid confirmation that this was an attack by the Assad government, or might it be that this was a false flag operation done by the rebels?
I mean, you never know when you're dealing with, you know, this type of situation. Right now, they are I know the UN is meeting in regards to the Syrian government itself,
right,
is what they're doing. So unless somebody comes up with some new information, and I've heard the stories myself about, you know, this could have been planned and staged, and why did it happen, you know, with the UN there. But again, nothing yet has pointed that it's no one but the Syrian government. So, I mean, yeah, if it would happen to be the rebels, they would be.
Has the Obama administration or the UN reacted officially to this?
The UN has. The UN Security Council is in an emergency session right now and to formulate a response. I think we're going to really know a lot out of that, and if they come directly out there. Now, the rumor on this emergency meeting that's taking place as we speak is they're aiming for a united formal statement. Now, that would require Russia.
Now, is this egregious enough and obvious enough to convince Russia that they need to change their position and stop supporting the Assad government? Because their position is basically the Assad government is the is the non-religious government, and we're with these guys because we don't want religious crazies running the country.
Well, that's right. And on this one, it would require Russia's assent to this, and that's going to be a lot of pressure. So this is going to be interesting to see if they can come out with a formal statement with the support of Russia. And if I think that happens, you will maybe be seeing the end of the Assad regime, because Russia's been its mainstay.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. If Russia pulls the rug out from underneath Assad, he's toast.
It's done.
Yeah. Huh. So we'll keep an eye on that. What else is up?
Well, I just have to shake my head in amazement that, you know, Hosni Mubarak has been ordered to be freed. Now, there can be a, because it was, you know, rumored they were going to do it. Now they have actually said, yes, he's free as early as tomorrow. Now, there is an appeal process that could occur and could not, but I find it just unbelievable on top of everything else. You have the, you know, former president who was supposedly in collusion with the military to kill protesters, and then, of course, the current military is killing protesters. You've got the Muslim Brotherhood. You might have Hosni Mubarak out on the street, and, of course, his supporters would be, you know, don't you miss him? Wasn't he better than what we have?
Right.
It just doesn't bode well for Egypt, this turn of news. Really, it doesn't.
Yeah, on the one hand. On the other hand, you know, I spent a fair amount of time in the Philippines back in the day, and we went through the Marcos government, and then Ferdy didn't come back, but one of his buddies did, and there was, you know, it kind of went back and forth and back and forth. And every time it went back and forth, I'm forgetting Gloria. What was her last name? The woman who replaced him.
Oh, my goodness. Aquino?
Aquino, yeah. Yeah, Cori Aquino. And she was good, you know. And then after her, there was somebody who wasn't. And it was kind of, it went back and forth. But it was like revolutions don't just kind of go in a straight line. It doesn't just all of a sudden get better and that's the end of it. You know, there's a little back and forth. And it's not inconceivable, at least to me, that he might come back chastened and do a somewhat reformed secular government and set the stage for more democratic elections. You think that's conceivable?
And of course, he's in some ill health, most likely now, but still his, you know, supporters are there. So
yeah,
it's just going to be a little bit of a different wrinkle.
It's going to be interesting.
Another story, because you follow a lot about, you know, the campaigns and clean government, et cetera. And I thought this was a fascinating story today, really. Congressman Chris Van Hollen, Democratic congressman, who was also head of the Democrat campaign committee at one point in time, and Public Citizen Advocacy are going to file an IRS lawsuit against the IRS about how they handle tax-exempt status groups. Which is interesting because the whole issue has been who are they spying on, the IRS.
Right.
This is saying you haven't really performed the task well. You're letting people who, you know, basically are lobbying,
right,
or using the.
Or let me translate this into plain English. Why the hell does Karl Rove have a multi-million-dollar PAC, nonprofit PAC?
Well, he was asked on TV, and I love picking on Karl Rove. When he was asked on TV, he answered, "Well, no, we support balancing the budget. That's our advocacy."
Right.
Well, you believe that?
Yeah.
So,
back when you were a Republican congressman, you heard that kind of rhetoric, and you know what it meant.
Well, Karl Rove would turn the PAC on anybody, including Republicans, if he wanted to, you know,
sure.
And that's a super PAC. I just thought it was a very interesting approach, what Chris Van Hollen is doing with public civic advocacy.
I agree.
And Benghazi, you know, the congressman from California is back at it again.
Daryl Issa?
Yes. He wants to know why people were not sanctioned or, you know, something done to the four people that should have known better, I guess is the best way to put it. And this committee said that, you know, they didn't handle some things appropriately, and the State Department has said they're not putting them back in their positions, but
yeah,
he wants to know.
Daryl Issa is trying so hard to be Joe McCarthy, and he keeps falling all over his own shoelaces, you know?
Right, he wants to be somebody.
Yeah, yeah.
He grows up.
And he has a long way to go. Bob Ney, former Congressman Bob Ney with the Talk Radio News Service, goatsfortheoldgoat.com. Thank you, Bob.
Thank you, sir.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Right now, Dianne Feinstein and other members of the U.S. Senate are trying to define the word press. Not Bill Press. Press, as in the First Amendment. To the press that's mentioned in the first line of the First Amendment of the Constitution. And no matter how well-intentioned their plan may be, this could backfire badly. We need to be paying attention to this. You know, the question, what is journalism? And I'm with Stuart Potter, the former U.S. Supreme Court Justice, who I think in the Linda Lovelace Deep Throat case, anyway, back in the day, said, I can't define porn, but I know it when I see it. Same thing with journalism. When news first broke back in May that the Justice Department was grabbing hold of the records, the phone records of AP reporters, and had tracked the movements of Fox News' James Rosen, it was actually a really great time for Congress to try to pass some strong protections, basically shield laws for freedom of the press, that thing that the First Amendment to the Constitution says is necessary for the necessary for a free state is the Second Amendment. But you get it. I mean, you can't have, you know, a free country without a free press. And the public was outraged about what the NSA was all up to. And big-name senators from both parties, Chuck Schumer from New York, Democrat, South Carolina's Republican Lindsey Graham, they were all saying, we need to have laws to protect journalists from prosecution. And now that bipartisan push for a media shield law has, shall we say, hit a snag. And that snag is senators like California's Dianne Feinstein, who don't think that bloggers and tweeters should have the First Amendment protections, the same First Amendment protections that reporters who work for Fox and the New York Times have. And this is a really big deal. This is a really important thing that we all need to be paying attention to, and you need to be talking to your members of Congress about. Right now, in its current form, the Senate's Media Shield Law requires the Justice Department to give any journalist and their organization a 45-day heads up when they want to snoop on them. And a journalist, according to the pending bill, is anyone who has, and I quote from the legislation, a primary intent to investigate events and procure material, end quote. Sounds pretty simple, right? Well, not so much for Dianne Feinstein. California senator told her colleagues earlier this month that she's worried that the word journalist is so vague that this proposed media shield law could, quote, provide special privileges to those who are not reporters at all. Apparently, in Senator Feinstein's opinion, real reporters have salaries. In other words, they work for official news agencies recognized by the Washington establishment. Senator Feinstein wants to make sure that the Senate's media shield law doesn't save WikiLeaks from prosecution. But if Congress were to limit media shield protections only to paid journalists, that would mean that any number of bloggers, like Glenn Greenwald, tweeters, independent citizen journalists, any of them could be prosecuted by the federal government for talking to a source, to a whistleblower, just because they don't take home a paycheck. And that is wrong. Journalism is not a profession, and journalism is not a person. It's an act. Anyone who comments on the news, anyone who cultivates sources, anyone who breaks a story about government or corporate corruption, that person is engaging in an act of journalism. Supreme Court Justice Potter Stewart once said about pornography that he knew it when he saw it. In my opinion, the same goes for journalism. You know it when you see it. Sounds vague, but it's true. The idea of journalism as an act and not as a just as a profession is especially relevant to today, because with the rise of internet and digital journalism, pretty much anyone who wants to be part of the press can be part of the press. You want to be a reporter? Fine. Start a Twitter account. I mean, you got to go out and find something to report on, but you can call yourself a reporter, and a lot of people do. You don't need a college degree. You don't need to have gone to J school. You just need good news sense and hard work. So if the purpose of the press is to inform the public, then bloggers and Twitter users and, frankly, even WikiLeaks fit the bill. They may not get paid for what they do, but what they do is an essential part of the democratic process. It's an essential part, a check, essentially, on the powers of government. It's the fourth estate. It's the unofficial fourth branch of government, and it's essential to American liberty. I mean, just think about this. Independent freelance blogs and organizations from, you know, WikiLeaks to you name it, Truthout, are arguably even better news sources than traditional media outlets because they are not compromised by corporate sponsors and they're open to anyone who can break a story. I mean, just consider how seriously the founders took this. The Constitution mentions only one industry by name, and that industry is the press. For the founding fathers, there was no institution more important for a democratic society than a free and independent media. So right there at the top of the Bill of Rights in the First Amendment, they wrote that Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech or of the press. But the press is a special industry. It should include everyone who publishes, who tweets, who comments on the news. It should include everyone who acts to inform the public. And those acts of journalism deserve protection, regardless of who does them or how. I've shared with you many times on this show, Thomas Jefferson once said, he'd rather have newspapers without a government than a government without newspapers. If Jefferson were alive today, there's no doubt in my mind, he would be saying the same thing about bloggers, tweeters, and WikiLeaks. If we want the First Amendment to keep us free, we all have to stand up and say to these legislators who are trying to decide who is and who is not the press, that the definition of the press has to be as all-inclusive as possible. We got to be about the First Amendment the way the NRA is about the Second. We got to be nuts about this. I mean, just emphatic. We have to demand that our elected representatives protect acts of journalism rather than just paid professional journalists. I know journalism when I see it. Glenn Greenwald was performing an act of journalism. Anyone who informs the public about what's going on in the world, in the halls of Congress and corporate boardrooms, on the streets of their city, they're engaging in journalism, period, end of story. And they are worthy of protection. Now, the Supreme Court is apparently not going to do it, even though we live in a constitutional monarchy, and the Supreme Court claims that they're the ones who have the official power to decide what's so and what's the law and who has what and all that kind of thing. But they've not come along and said, you know, they protected free speech to the extent that they protect billionaires. Yes, you can buy elections. You can run all the ads you want. You can, you know, change people's minds. You can lie to people. They protect billionaires. They protect political parties. They protect corporations. But they haven't weighed in to protect the independent press, the independent media, the person who might just see somebody doing something wrong on the street, whether it's a police officer or a representative of Dow Chemical, and video it with their phone, commit an act of journalism, and then be confronted by the police on behalf of that powerful person, saying, okay, give me your phone, kid. No. I'm a journalist. I'm protected. Supreme Court is not going to weigh in on this because it would mean weighing in on the side of the little guy. They're not going to do that. We have to require our legislators to do it.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So give them a call, especially your senators, and say media shield laws have to protect acts of journalism as well as journalists. Twenty minutes past the hour, Bill in Laurel, Montana, just shared an insight with us that just totally blew my mind. It just hadn't occurred to me. When Bill Clinton changed the welfare to workfare requirements, basically said, you can only draw welfare for a short time, and after that, you've got to go to work. And once you go to work, if you're paid such a lousy wage, you know, flipping burgers or working at, Walmart or whatever, if you're paid such a lousy wage, you can continue to get food stamps and you can continue to get some housing assistance, but you have to work. What he was doing was basically creating a system that forces people in the bottom 20th of our population, the bottom quintile of our population, that forces them to take low-wage jobs, which the Walmarts of the world and the McDonald's of the world, they love this. Because now they've got people who are, you know, basically indentured servants. They can't hold out for a better job. They can't say, no, I won't work for that lousy wage. Because if they don't work, they will not be eligible for food stamps or for housing assistance because they get cut off from those things. And so, they're forced into the open arms of the low-wage employers. The question in my mind, now that I've been enlightened about this, is, was this an intended consequence or an unintended consequence of these laws? And I'll bet it was an intended consequence. Not to make Bill Clinton all Machiavellian, but there was a whole bunch of his folks in his administration, the Robert Rubens and Larry Summerses of the world, who loved this idea. That's amazing. That's absolutely amazing. Regina in Teaneck, New Jersey. Hey, Regina, what's on your mind today? You want to talk about food stamps?
Hi, Tom. Basically, what I wanted to say is it sort of combines that with the conversation that you had with Bob Ney and all the, you know, with Dick Armey and his and the other right wing groups. I mean, my thing is this: if people are that gullible, then they deserve what they get. I mean, all they have to do is look back in history. Republicans have never been on the side of poor people or just the average Joe. They've never been on that side. They fought everything, you know.
With one
all the programs that were designed to help people, they pretty much fought against them, and they're continuing to do that today. The words that come out of their mouth are exactly the words that you can hear from, you know, 30, 40, 50 years ago. So I don't understand how anybody could believe what they say, especially about the healthcare. Who could say, why would anybody, it's like, it's crazy. Like, why would anybody want to deny themselves healthcare?
Right. And why does NPR put them on the air without somebody talking back to them?
Right.
That's what blows my mind. Is I find myself almost every morning screaming at the radio, going, "What? You say what?"
and
Jim DeMint, what?
It makes no sense.
Yeah. I'm with you.
And then you have all these. That's why I really also believe that you need to get we need to get money out of politics, because who are these rich people to tell us, the regular Joe, what we need to do? They have no clue how people of, you know, that are in certain income levels live. They have no clue.
Yeah, because they've never been of modest means themselves, or if they were, it was back during the Eisenhower years when there was actually, I mean, you know, there were jobs available, and it wasn't, well, I for minorities, it was still just as grim as it is now. For white people, it wasn't quite as bad, but it's still they just don't have any recollection. I think Regina, you got it. I think you nailed it. Thank you for the call. Brilliant. Colleen in Traverse City, Michigan. Hey, Colleen, what's up?
Hi. Well, Tom, I really have enjoyed your show, and it's very hard to narrow myself down on this topic. But I was listening today, starting back when Peter Ferrara was on there and talking about how awful it was that there were people that just suck off of welfare and don't like to work or something. I
sleep until noon.
They
sleep until noon, he said.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God.
I was working until recently, but my job included a lot of driving. Mm-hmm. One day I found that the circulation to my legs was cut off, the nerves to my legs from hours of driving, and so I had to stop working that job, which was part-time anyway, but and no benefits, of course. But anyway, I now receive the grand total of $106 a month in food stamps. I'd like to know where these people are that are making $40,000 a year on welfare. It's something I've never heard of.
They don't exist. They don't exist. Yeah, they exist in the imagination of the Cato Institute.
Peter Ferrara can live on $106 a month. I congratulate him. Yeah. I have to avail myself of the local food pantries for additional assistance. I do also have some rent assistance. Where I'm staying is one of these, where the landlord gets low interest in order to make property available, rental property, to lower-income people. However, the rent, I think, is fairly high, and the difference, of course, goes to the landlords, not to me. I pay about half of my disability benefit monthly in rent, and then, of course, I have utilities and whatnot on top of that. So I have, you know, approximately $10 or $20 to stretch through the rest of the month for all of my luxuries that Peter would think I have. And it really outrages me that on the news there's so little mention of how much corporate welfare. I know you bring it up, but I only recently got DirecTV, and it's, of course, it's not available on the cable stations, or I don't have internet because I don't have a computer anymore. You know, a lot of people are not hearing any of the other side of the story. They're just getting, as you say, the CNN version or whatever, which is mostly how lucky or the celebrities are living exciting, glorious lives and everything.
Yes, yes. All the bonbons you're buying with your $100 a month for food. That's Colleen, thank you for sharing a real story and telling our viewers and our listeners your unreal life experience. It took a lot of courage, and I appreciate it. Thank you for the call. And we'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And in this month in history, President Bush and John McCain celebrated John McCain's birthday while Louisiana drowned. Most Republicans in Louisiana, though, don't remember. The good, the bad, and the very, very anapodictically ugly, the good. The Ted Cruz hecklers. A group of protesters confronted rookie Texas Senator Ted Cruz. Shouldn't we call him Canadian Senator Ted Cruz? At an event in Dallas yesterday and blasted him for trying to defund Obamacare. They yelled, "You have health care, so can we." Check this out.
There is a new paradigm. Gentlemen, thank you for sharing your views. You know, part of the First Amendment is about respecting the views of others. Sir?
Right, those protesters are spot on. The fact that Cruz and other far-right senators want to stop tens of millions of Americans from getting affordable or even free health care while they themselves have free health care is frankly shameful. The bad. Paul Taylor, the Creation Today program host, has some interesting theories about the behavior of the king of lizards, Tyrannosaurus Rex. Check this one out.
One thing is for sure, that the pteropod dinosaurs, like Tyrannosaurus, were not created to eat meat. God created all creatures to eat plants, and he gave some of them sharp teeth so that they would be able to do so.
Right. There's just so much wrong with that clip. First off, T-Rex wasn't created. It evolved from earlier dinosaurs through natural selection. And second of all, while some scientists do think the T-Rex was a scavenger and didn't kill all of its meals, it certainly ate meat. If creationists want to be taken seriously, they might want to get their basic facts straight first. But again, they're creationists, so facts aren't really their thing in the first place. You know, as a vegetarian, I'd actually kind of like to support that, but it's crazy. Anyhow. And the very, very ugly, Benny Hinn and Jerry Mungadze. Earlier this week, Hinn, a prominent televangelist, and Mungadze on his show to talk about the latter's ex-gay therapy work. During their discussion, Mungadze claimed that he could identify whether a person was demonized, his code word for gay, by observing what colors they used to draw their brain. Check that one out.
Now, one thing that surprised me is for many, many years when I lived in Africa, I saw people that were demonized, but I didn't know that you can actually see demonization in people's brains, which I can now.
Wait, stop. You can see demonization in people's brains?
Yeah.
How?
There's a certain color that I won't mention that tells me if someone is demonized.
Oh. Now, let me explain what he just said to you. What he has you do, and by the way, we're going to show you materials that you can have on your own. He divided the brain into different parts, and each part speaks of one area of your life. And by the colors you choose, you take colored pencils, and you color every area. He can tell you everything about yourself.
Right. But Hinn and Mungadze actually take this hateful quack science seriously and are promoting it on Hinn's show is very, very odd. Benny Hinn is just a... You know, I used to be into listening to these Christian evangelists. There was a time in my life in my 20s where I was very into it, actually. And even then, I knew that Benny Hinn was... Well, maybe it was a little after that he got so famous. But, you know, you can tell the hustlers, right? You can identify the hustlers. Lynn in North Bend, Oregon. Hey, Lynn, what's up?
Yes, hello. I just
was hoping to talk about the new jobs that we need for the youth especially. Yeah, and it's time on this planet, as we do have worldwide internet and cell phones, to replace the old paradigm, you know, of all the drugging, the street drugs, the pharmaceuticals, and coping with drugs, pharmaceuticals, and violence, and warring. And really, we can put these new healing, multicultural, I see these multicultural healing, teaching, and transformation centers in every community, and start developing the sole purpose developmental programs, but also to the green jobs, edible landscapers, natural foods and remedies, you know, industrial hemp. Light workers are the spiritual activists on the planet. There's billions of us. Where are the jobs? These are spiritual activists. Like I said, they can actually help unite the churches. Yep. And be of helping healing community services. All the healing artists instead of all the body, mind, spirit healers, they're in every city too. And why aren't they being put?
Lynn, I am totally with you. And in fact, I think that, you know, body, mind, spirit healers should be covered under Obamacare, among other things. So, Lynn, thank you for the call. Excellent point. Rick in Columbus, Ohio. Hey, Rick, 20% tipping for politicians? Rick? I think Rick was on hold too long. Okay, James in Oak Harbor, Washington. You wanted to talk about food stamps?
Oh, James.
That's you.
Me.
Yeah, you're on the air, James.
God bless you. Fight the good fight. Most of my friends are Joe Sixpack mentality with a Glenn Beck education. And I link your website to mine, so they might have that.
Okay.
It might be why you got all those weird calls last week. I don't know.
Okay. But the point you wanted to make, James, was what?
Oh, right. I'm a disabled veteran. My daughter's spina bifida baby in a wheelchair. She has a daughter.
That's a tough one.
$600 a month.
Yeah. Yeah. My niece had a daughter with spina bifida who died just a few years ago in her early 20s. And that's a brutal disease. That is such a brutal, brutal thing. And to have to live on, just living on the edge on government assistance, it is so sad the way that we here in the United States treat the least fortunate and among us. James, thank you for the call. I wish you the very best. And thanks for your blessing, your well wishes. Liz in North Aurora, Illinois. Hey, Liz, what's up?
Hi. In 1996, I became disabled, and now I'm very political, and I love your show.
Thank you.
But I wanted to tell you that, you know how the founders of the Constitution didn't know that you can make guns into automatic weapons?
Yeah, the Gatling gun wasn't invented until the 19th century.
Yeah, but, muskets were, they thought those were really cool. But
they didn't
even
have bullets during the Revolution, you know.
Anyway, I was going to say that they had no clue that death was caused by cancer or viruses or bacteria or breakers, stuff like that. So they didn't know all these cells were, and genetics, and things could be cured with medical care. Mm. So, and also, things could be paid for. And Obamacare.
So you're suggesting that this is why the founders didn't write Obamacare or single payer health care into the Constitution, and for that matter, gun control, because they never anticipated an AR-14. You know, I don't disagree with you, Liz. Although the first president to sign legislation providing for free food, free housing, and free clothing and free medical care for the poor here in the city of Washington, D.C., the first president to sign that legislation was George Washington. So they did have some sense of we are all in this together. And, you know, then Ben Franklin started the post office and the fire departments and the public libraries. And there was a whole lot of public spiritedness back in the day. But, Liz, I think you're absolutely right. They didn't anticipate the automatic muskets. And if they had, I think they would have written the Second Amendment differently. Although we have to acknowledge that the Second Amendment was written for the Southern legislators to be able to keep their slave patrols to maintain the institution of slavery, And for the northern legislators, it was to appease their fear of a standing army that might threaten individual state sovereignties. So, Liz, thank you for the call. And thanks for listening to WCPT. Jeff in San Diego. Hey, Jeff, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Nice to talk with you, and good to be on your show.
Thank you.
All the problems that we have in the country today cause, you know, whether it's political or economic or social or whatever, can be solved by most of the population coming together underneath one national organization. And that one national organization, I would say, could be a cooperative, and a consumer cooperative, which means that they come together for the basic reason of providing food, housing, energy, education, communication, transportation, health care, and finance at cost.
I think you're describing a variation, arguably, on Marxism, aren't you?
Well,
and I don't mean that as a slur. I mean that as just as...
No, I understand what you're saying, but it's basically, it's been taken, our government's been taken away, our economy's taken away, we no longer have, we feel like grain of sand, you know, so helpless, but, you know, I say get together and become the whole beach.
Yeah.
You know, it means that if you can come, if you can get enough people to come together as consumers, because that's where
right.
it starts, from the very beginning, as a consumer.
Yeah.
Whether you it's what you purchase or it's what you pay in taxes.
Jeff, let me tell you the one alarm bell that goes off for me when you say this is you say one giant organization. I'm a big fan of lots and lots of small slivered organizations. I am haunted. I lived in Germany for a year. I read Mein Kampf. I read Scherer's book, The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich. And I'm haunted by the fact that Hitler was saying, we are going to create 1,000 years of peace by having just one organization. That's my one wariness.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
But I think your idea is brilliant. I think if we created the opportunity for all kinds of local co-ops, that it would do the same thing. But we can talk about it more another time. Jeff, thank you for the call. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Catherine in Seattle says, you're a cynic too? Really?
I am a cynic, and, a lot of people would call you a cynic, by the way.
I suppose,
but I
don't think I am. I think I'm an optimist.
I don't see that particularly. I mean, you're pretty harsh with a lot of people, but that's okay. This government is based on lies. I mean, I'm tired of the lies. I'm very cynical.
Mm-hmm.
And, I have had so many experiences. Let me just give you one experience. I was in Moscow when Lee Harvey Oswald was there in the same place, October 26th.
In the radio factory, you mean?
No, I was at the Moscow consulate in Moscow. American
oh, when he
consulate.
Was... Okay.
And 1959.
Uh-huh.
And that's where I got really cynical.
Huh.
I'll tell you why. Because, this guy was screaming on the other side of the door. I could hear everything he said. And he didn't mean anything to me. He hadn't shot Kennedy yet.
Yeah.
I don't think he ever did. And I'll tell you why. This fellow came roaring out of the door and hit me. I got a good look at him. That was not Lee Harvey Oswald. Now, fast forward to the Los Angeles Times years later, 1963. I was sitting there reading about Moscow in 1926, 1959, Lee Harvey Oswald. That was not Lee Harvey Oswald.
Huh.
That was a short, heavy-set man. And he was, I had this verified by what they said in Mexico City. They showed a picture of, the embassies down there. This was not Lee Harvey Oswald.
Yeah.
Now, what's going on in this country? I mean, that's where I got very cynical. That's
sure.
not Lee Harvey Oswald.
Sure.
Was he a peasant?
So here's the question, or the issue, I guess, Catherine. A genuine cynic would say, game over. That's it. You know, we're screwed. We're toast. They've been lying to us. They've been gaming us. They own the system.
Yeah.
You know, let's just go out and have a drink. Eat, drink, and be merry, because tomorrow we're also going to be slaves. And an optimist would say, okay, a realist and an optimist, which I think I am both, would say, yeah, that's true. You know, I don't know about your story with Lee Oswald, but it is true that we have been lied to a lot by our government, that we are continually being lied to by our government and by our corporations and by our billionaires and by our politicians. Sometimes we're told the truth. Sometimes good stuff happens. Sometimes bad stuff happens. But all of that we need to look at with a clear eye and ask ourselves every single day the question, what can I do to make this a better world? And then do it. And that's where cynics don't take that next step. And that's why I would not call myself a cynic.
I haven't heard any information about what to do about what's happening.
Okay, well, let me give you a great starting point. This is one of my favorites. If you have the access to the Internet, go to movetoamend.org. Over 500 communities, including some 20 states now, I believe, have passed resolutions saying we need to amend the United States Constitution to say that corporations don't have the rights of persons under the Bill of Rights, and that billionaires cannot use their money as if it was free speech. These are doctrines that were completely invented by the Supreme Court and that have largely led to the takeover of our government that you're describing. If we the people can pass this, and we can do it without the federal government even being involved, if we get enough states, you know, if enough people active in enough states, if we can pass this constitutional amendment, we can roll the United States back to the progressive era, and we can start making really significant changes. And there is a huge national movement to make this happen. I wrote a book about it called Unequal Protection, but there's other good ones out there as well. That's one starting point. There are other great organizations out there that are doing what they can. Tim Carpenter's group, Progressive Democrats of America, PDA, they're not affiliated with the Democratic Party at all. They stand on the outside, and they push Democrats as hard as they can to be progressives, and they work to get progressives elected in primaries and to help people of goodwill infiltrate the Democratic Party. I'd love to see people of goodwill infiltrate, the Republican Party as well. But, you know, if we just sit around and wring our hands, this country will go down the tubes. We have to do something, Catherine. And there are, if nothing else, just show up at your local Democratic Party and say, I want to volunteer. I want to be the voice inside who is going to be speaking truth to power rather than the person on the outside who is just complaining about being helpless.
Yeah, but I'm not helpless. I've done all the things you've said.
Okay. Well, good. Then you're part of the solution. It won't, you know, when Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony got together in November of 1874 and decided that that week Susan Anthony was going to go down to the polling place and vote, they hoped that in their lifetimes they would see women have the right to vote. She went down, she voted, she got arrested. Within a month, she had paid the fine, and they didn't send her to jail, but she was taken to jail. But, you know, she paid the fine, and it kicked off. Now, it had already been going. I mean, Abigail Adams, John Adams' wife, was a large part of it during pre-revolutionary times, of a women's movement in the United States. But Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony never lived to see the day that women could vote. And yet, if they hadn't done what they did, that small act of civil disobedience, followed by, you know, publicizing it and promoting it, you probably wouldn't be able to vote today. It's like, don't ever think that even small actions, joining Move to Amend, showing up for the Democratic Party, don't have consequences. They do. They really do. And we all need to be involved. We need to step up. It's not enough to just complain about things. In fact, it's not even a particularly useful thing to complain about things. One of the guiding principles for me when I do this show is I don't talk about things, I don't complain about things unless I can offer a solution. And I wish more people in radio and television did that on the right and the left. There has to be something that we can do as the next step. Otherwise, it's just like, you know, hey, let's just get drunk. And that's not going to help anything. Catherine, thank you for the call. It's a very thoughtful call, and I honor your integrity and your concern. Coming up tomorrow, we'll have the latest on Senator Ted Cruz. Is he Canadian? Can he legally run for president? Dr. Jerry Corsi is going to be with us, the guy who started the whole Obama birther thing. This is going to be a hoot. Plus, Mike Papatonio, Ring of Fire Radio, is going to be here on the important issues of the day. And don't forget, democracy does begin with you. Get out there, get active, do something. Tag, you're it. I'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.